All right, testing. Testing 1, 2, 3. We're starting today's class on Koheles momentarily. And we'll just do a regular brief audio check. And we'll start in about 2 minutes. And we're going to be reading from the very beginning of Koheles, King Solomon's work, Ecclesiastes. And we just read this on the Sukkot holiday. So we'll take up a number of the initial verses. And once you hear the audio feed, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen for those of you that are joining us online. And we'll just wait a moment for friends to join us by phone. Okay, JHS, thanks a lot for the audio confirmation. And if you ever join the class and you come in late, we do record all the classes and put them online. They're under the audio link. That's about 9 links down on the left-hand side of the Masorah website. And we will pause at a few intervals throughout the class to hear any of your questions or your comments. We also learned recently that Firefox has some issues with playing the Windows Media files, the live audio streams, so it's preferable to use Internet Explorer. You can also use this on the Mac as well. Okay, Helen Esther, thanks for the audio confirmation. And hello to Alberto. Nice to see you again. And we're just about ready to start. Good morning, Doug. Morning, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. Doing well. How's it going out there?
It is a beautiful sunshiny day in the greater Seattle area.
Yeah. What's the temperature?
Probably about 35 or 40.
Youch.
Oh, Cal, tell me I'm wrong. 45.
45, okay.
Not too bad.
Yeah, same here. Really nice day. Hope to see a little bit of the foliage later today.
Oh, yeah. The leaves must be gorgeous.
Yeah. Nice time of the year. Okay, so let's get started over here. What I do today is we may have touched on in the past. Have we done any of the book of Ecclesiastes, Kohelis?
No, I don't believe we have.
Okay. Rabbi Chait, years ago, gave a series of lectures on it, probably for over a year. He was doing it pretty much every Sunday. But in his initial lectures are really very astounding. And what I'm going to say today is mostly based on his explanation of the introductory verses. So let's take it. This is, again, the beginning of Ecclesiastes, right in the beginning. I'll wait a moment if anybody wants to get a hold of the text. Okay. It really is very, very important. And we just actually read it on Sukkot. Reading it and studying it, two separate things. And this Rabbi Chait's approach is just really phenomenal. And how's the sound? Sound is okay on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Hopefully he'll be joining us soon. Okay, so let's take it. So Rabbi Chait commenced by explaining the first number of verses. The words of Kohelis, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, king in Jerusalem. So why does he call himself Kohelis, which means a congregation? That's the root of the word Kohelis, is Kehila. Or Kahal. So Rabbi Chait mentioned that he was expressing the fact that he discussed his ideas with many people. So they aren't just ideas that came to him, but they were there were other people that acted as a sounding board. So he's trying to influence the reader that he should pay attention to what he's saying, since the ideas are tried and tested. Then he says that he's the son of David, which means that he was the son of a tremendously wise person. An additional reason to listen to his words, and the fact that Solomon was king in Jerusalem, means to say that he had everything at his disposal. But the king is the one that everything is open to. So he was in the perfect position to study and to research and to test ideas and then to disseminate them. So that's why he first opens the book with that statement. Now he makes his very famous claim. Futility of futilities. Hevel Havalim, Amar Kohelis. Futility of futilities, does Kohelis say. All is futile. Hakol Hevel. The answer is Amar Kohelis. Hevel Havalim. The futility of futilities. He repeats it again. And it concludes in the second verse that everything is futile. So the rabbis mentioned in a midrashic, or not midrashic, but a drash type of an approach, they say if you count all the terms of futile in this verse, so there's a singular form, and then there's words where it's the plural form. So if you count them, it ends up to be a total of seven. And what King Solomon was saying is that everything that's in seven, meaning the creation was in 7 days, so all of creation is futile. So the rabbis immediately ask, how can King Solomon say this when God said in Genesis, after every day, v'hi tov, that it would behold it's good. So God says the creation is a good, and King Solomon seems to be contradicting God's words by saying that the physical world is futile. So the answer that King Solomon is talking about the person who pursues the physical as an ends in itself. Then it's futile. If a person uses the physical world as the end of all of his pursuits, and there's nothing beyond that, then it's futile. God was talking about the physical world as a means for us to approach him as a creator. So the entire world man can use properly to investigate God's wisdom and his kindness, his mercy, all his ways. So that resolves the conflict. But the first thing that King Solomon wants to open up to us is that if a person is seeking the physical world as it ends, and this is the umbrella for the rest of the book, so if this is the person's attitude, so then he's going to find everything is futile, because the physical world in and of itself cannot supply man with what he's looking for. So of course we have to ask the question, what is man looking for? That he's saying it's a futile endeavor. Well, what's futile? Eating a fruit tastes good? No. What is the futility that he's talking about? So he's talking about a person seeking happiness. If he's trying to, because that is really the bottom line, whatever person is trying to do in life, and if a person is trying to seek happiness from merely chasing after the physical, so then it will end in being a futile endeavor. Because God did not design man that he could be satisfied purely with the physical. If he uses it properly in the right context, then yes. But man has a tzelem elokim, man has a soul. So if he is not addressing that, if he's not pursuing wisdom, then he's going to feel a great void, a great deal of dissatisfaction in life, because the essential part of his nature is not being addressed. Okay, and now he goes into the specifics. Okay. So in verse 3 he says, what is the benefit, the extra benefit, the yeser, means the additional benefit to man, the chol amola, with all of his toil, sheyamol tachas hashemesh, that he works and he toils under the sun, meaning on earth. What is the yisron, what is the benefit to man and all the work that he toils under the sun? And Rashi says two words on this. He says the wage, meaning the actual result, the productivity of his activities, umosar, and also and further, and additional. So again, King Solomon is not saying that there's no benefit to work a field and to have the food to eat. He's saying, my yisron, what is the extra to man? So what do you think that extra is that he's looking for that King Solomon is rejecting as worthwhile? And Rashi also says that.
So, Rabbi, Rashi's saying in verse 3, in the answer to the question in verse 3, the answer is the wage and the additional?
Yes. But that's part of the question, though.
So, I would presume that the wage would be the practical part of what man gets for all his labor, which he toils beneath the sun. In other words, he goes to work, he gets wages, he uses that to buy food and have clothing and shelter, all the very physical, practical things.
Right.
But that the additional... would it have to be something along the lines of what he learns in the process, or is it the learning that goes along in as a part of that that you get by the sheer fact that you went through all that? Because every time, you know, when you just go out to virtually any job, there's learning, and I don't mean learning about how to do the job, but the interaction with people, and you get to see things about yourself and, you know, so forth. And then, or it means the additional that you get in the opportunity to learn because you've taken care of the physical needs and they're satisfied, you've now got the, energy and maybe even the leisure time to involve yourself in learning.
So what is the extra? What is the extra that a person is looking for that he's rejecting? Because he's saying, what benefit, what additional benefit is there to man with all the toil that he works under the sun?
would guess that it's the what Rashi's what I'm thinking Rashi's referring to as the additional, which is the learning that you get over and above just the direct results of your toil.
Well, that's a good. Why would King Solomon reject wisdom?
Well, okay, is he rejecting that?
Yes.
Is three a real question, or is three almost a sarcastic question?
Yeah, you could say it's sarcastic. It's sarcasm. Well, I would say sarcasm, but it's like rhetorical.
So he's making the statement the man doesn't really get any profit.
Right, but he's trying to point you to the fact that what? The man is looking for something additional. This is the point of his verse. He's saying, meaning that there's something which is a fact that he is now rejecting. So now we have to deduce what is it that he is now addressing over here. So he's saying, what's the benefit, the additional benefit the man gets with all his work under the sun? That means there must be something which man is seeking as an addition, quote unquote. But he doesn't say what it is, but he clearly rejects it.
Well, there's a certain, what would you call, sense of satisfaction or fulfillment, or fulfilling the, whatever the ultimate purpose of a person is.
Okay, good. And if we would just give a word to that, that would be considered accomplishment. Meaning what fulfills a person is that he has this concept of accomplishment. There is definitely that's part of the psyche, where a person is looking for that. But he is now rejecting that. He's saying if a person wants to toil and to, he has to build a home and he has to have food and clothing, so those are all, of course, those are necessities. Those are proper pursuits. But man, typically, will also, in his mind, not only go to work and provide for his family and all, but then in his mind, he's building an empire for himself. That's just one example of many forms that the sense of accomplishment seeks. The ego is really behind that. He's looking for, it's part of the self-image. So if we're sensitive to that, I think we could all identify that feeling that we've had at one point or another in life, and that's a definite real feeling. The question is whether that's a worthwhile pursuit, that we should be looking for that, or like King Solomon is saying, no, that is not something which a person should really put energies into. Just do your work. And Sforno actually touches on this a bit. He says, what's the benefit to man and all the work that he works under the sun? And he, King Solomon, says this on the work of man underneath the sun in matters that are temporal. For what purpose is there with this? And why should a person be so diligent in this area at all? Why should the Tselem Elokim, he says, try to reach this? Meaning in terms of the real definition of what's good for man, we have to trace back to what is man primarily. He's an intelligent being. So therefore, if that's really the core of man is his soul, his intelligence. So that should really be the barometer by which we measure any act as being worthwhile or not. And if a person is just pursuing fantasy in his mind, that really do not translate to anything real, because the sense of accomplishment is phony. If a person is satisfied that he's clothing his family and that what he actually worked for is doing, it's serving his purpose, that's a good feeling. That type of satisfaction is good. But if he's now looking for something on top of that, now he has an image of himself as a successful businessman, things of that nature, that's what he's criticizing here. All right, you see the difference between being satisfied with the actual work itself and what the real purpose of the work is, and then the secondary layer that a person adds on top of that, which King Solomon says is futile. We see the difference?
I think so. So, well, I guess I'm... Is there a very clear line between those?
Oh, certainly.
Shades of gray.
No, it's a black and white. I mean, it's basically if a person... Again, just imagine yourself doing your work, your weekly work, and providing for your family and yourself and having your needs taken care of and whatever, you know, breaks you need, or taking your wife out for dinner, whatever the, you know, the person has to enjoy themselves. They have to live within their means, but they also have to have that time off, a little break here and there. They should also enjoy the work. But that's all the actual, that's the true purpose of why the person's working. But now you take another person who does the same thing, but now he's carrying in his mind this image of a successful businessman. That has nothing to do with what the products of his labor are. The products of his labor were to clothe and feed and shelter his family. Now he's carrying around an additional image in his head which doesn't do good for anybody. That's a futile thing. And that's really what, you know, motivates the secular world. Image, self-image, success. And everywhere you can express your success in designer labels and the highest priced cars and the most expensive homes on villas in Europe. I mean, these are all things that are completely over and above what man really needs. And like Swarner says, this is not doing anything for his intelligence. An intelligent life is not being addressed with these superfluous notions that he has and these attempts at self-aggrandizement. Even if he doesn't tell anybody, he just carries the thought around in his head of being the great businessman and so on and so forth. A doctor too, he heals a lot of people. That is the objective, to heal the people. But now he walks around, I'm the great physician, and he has this image in his head. That would be the same thing.
Rabbi, I find that very interesting because, you know, when you work around or are affiliated with elderly people, most of their depression seems to be linked with a lack of purpose, a sense of accomplishment.
And that was a false idea that they fed on during their whole life, and that's why it's finally biting them at the end. If they didn't live that way and they just live the right way, they would not have that. The rabbis say, Ode Yanuvim Beseva. They were meaning the person who lives a righteous life, he will be fresh and vigorous in his old age. It'll actually be a great part of his life. He'll be most perfected with the years of study and involvement in ideas. So then he shed these notions that the world looks at. And that's what King Solomon is doing. He's trying to educate a person now, so they don't end up in that state where they're depressed. Right? So that's the extra. You have to realize that the human psyche is a created by God, a tremendously deep and complex construct. Many layers, many facets. And again, King Solomon is the one who, at 12 years old, God gave him wisdom overnight. Okay. So that's the third verse. Let me just pause here and see if there's any other questions or comments before we move on.
I'm good.
Yeah, I find myself jumping to the end of the mental end of the whole thing because I recall, you know, how he ends, but we should wait to get there.
Right. Okay. So now, that's verse 3. Right, but you see that's right at the beginning of his book. Because he's saying that man initially is chasing after futilities. Now, just going back to the previous verse, so there's one idea that the rabbis said, and that, you know, it's the futility of futilities. So they counted it up 7 times. So that we discussed. Now, what Rabbi Chase said is a beautiful concept. He said like this. He said, what exactly is, I mean, I understand what a futility is, something which is a worthwhile pursuit. Right? We can all agree on that, right? But what is a futility of a futility? That's what he says in the verse 2. Havel havolim, the futility of futilities. That means besides the futile search for more money than you can spend, there's another futility. And he said an amazing answer. He said that besides the actual futility itself, the activity, the pursuit on earth, there's the fantasy that one attaches to it in his mind, which is also futile, which is very similar to the next verse. But the general rule is that man, in his pursuits, will create an image in his mind, a fantasy of something, which itself is a futility. I mean, that is as nonsensical as the actual pursuit of the futility. We understand it's good to, you know, procure food, clothing, and shelter for yourself, your family, your loved ones, your friends, to give charity, so on and so forth. That is the right pursuit as a means. But when we go into excess, and when we build up images in our mind about that before we even start pursuing it, now there's two futilities. There's the fantasy that precedes the activity, because we buy into all these notions that advertising feeds us, and then we go after it in action. So the fantasy that we accept and we follow is one futility. The real futility, of course, is going after it. But the value that we attribute to it, the fantasy, is a separate futility. That's what it means, havel havolim. And that really lays the groundwork, the foundation for this book, because he's talking about numerous psychological truths that people just are not in touch with, because people don't reflect. People haven't studied psychology. But if they hear it, then the idea is clear to them. They understand it because they sense that they have these types of foolish notions. So that's a very important verse right there, the second verse. Havel havalim, the futility of futilities. That means it's the futility itself. And then there's what precedes it, the fantasy that one attributes to what he's going to now pursue. So if we're sensitive to this, we can really diffuse a lot of wasted energy. If we could think into whether something is worthwhile, and then realize that we do have this type of idea, we fantasize about the perfect vacation. By the time we get there, it's raining, half the luggage is missing, and you missed your plane, and you had to wait 3 hours in the airport. I mean, if we think back into all these different fantasies that we had, and how do they actually play out in reality? If that's what we're looking for, the happiness, so then forget it. The actual activity is we build it up so much, so that's the fantasy about it. I'm not saying that a vacation is wrong. A person needs a break. But let's just be realistic about how we approach it. If we are realistic, then we won't have that letdown, like Cal mentioned, that the elderly people that are feeling that they're missing now, because they never really got it to begin with. They should have been dissatisfied when they first started, when they were in their 20s and 30s. But they could not abandon the way the world works, and they were very impressed by the masses, and it was impossible for them to detach. They feel everybody's doing something, it must have a truth to it. Okay. Ideas clear?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. And then you see now how one of the fantasies now, it plays right in. Verse 3 follows right away. And that is that what is one, what is an expression of what he mentioned in verse 2? And well, one of the fantasies is that additional sense of accomplishment that a person is looking for. So there you have the additional layer that a person places on something, even before he does it. But the person carries it with him even while he's pursuing it as well. So it coexists, but it also precedes it in time. Okay. But you see, this is all takas hashama, under the sun, as he says in the end of verse 3. That means anything which is limited to your earthly stay, if that's where you're putting your energy as an ends in itself, then forget it. It's not going to give you the satisfaction you're looking for. All right.
So, yes. Just to clarify, though, he's not suggesting that, I mean, in verse 3, or in verse 2, I mean, he's saying all is futile. So, is he saying something there about the person that just goes to work or goes out to the farm and does what they need to do to earn a living so they can eat and have a roof over their head and so forth?
Right, he's not addressing that. That's the proper lifestyle.
Okay.
Yeah, the rabbis even say in Ethics of the Fathers that if there's any, the ein kemach ein Torah, if there's no flour, there won't be any Torah. I mean, if you don't work to have your sustenance, which they use as the phrase, flour, you know, your daily bread, So then you can't possibly be involved in Torah. You'd be so concerned about your livelihood that you won't have the peace of mind. So a person most definitely has to work. That's what God said to Adam. We read it yesterday in the weekly parsha in Genesis. That by the sweat of your brow you'll eat bread. Okay, now let's read the next verse and see if we can understand what he's addressing. Remember, every time he says something, he's addressing a misnomer. Verse 4. A generation comes and a generation goes. Actually, no, the opposite. A generation expires and another generation comes. But the earth will exist always. Okay, so what is he addressing over here?
Well, it sounds like he's addressing the fantasy that some have of sort of immortality by, setting up statues of themselves or having the street named after them or something that they think will outlast them.
Exactly. Right. Immortality fantasy. Now, why is he addressing this now?
Futilities. Isn't it one of the futilities that kind of go along with what we've already been talking about?
Yes, and it's a very primary one. And you see that yesterday's Parsha, the weekly Parsha, also addressed this. When God said, now that man is eaten from the tree of knowledge and he knows and he's become like one of us to know good and evil, now perhaps he'll extend his hand and take from the tree of life and he'll live forever. So God guarded off the path back to the tree of life, so man should not be involved. But evidently, there was that concern. Man had that concern. As soon as he became mortal, because man initially was going to live forever. He was not going to die. And we clearly see that because God says, do not eat from the tree of knowledge, because when you do, you will die. The day you eat from it, you will now be a mortal individual. It doesn't mean you'll drop dead on the spot. It means now you're going to be transferred from a immortal being to a mortal being. And once Adam recognized that, and he saw that law, so now there was the desire to want to extend his stay on earth, and he would eat from the tree of life that would provide that. So God had to guard the way back. Interesting is that why doesn't God just get rid of that tree? No, the tree has to exist for some reason, but he sets up these things called the Kruvim, which are like childlike images, and the flaming sword that spun around like an unapproachable, something you just can't approach. You can't defend yourself against the sword. And my understanding of what this means is that these objects may very well have existed, but I'm sure there's other ideas over there. And that, I believe, is saying that now that man was going to die, so he was more involved in the immortality fantasy. He didn't have the immortality fantasy before because he was immortal. So there's no need to have the fantasy about it. But once he was punished with mortality, because his, just like in the generation of the flood, the age, the longevity, and the stature of those people contributed to their sense of being invulnerable. So they took whatever wives they wanted, and they stole whatever they wanted. They felt invincible. So after the flood, you'll note the very quick drop in the lifespans of those individuals. From 1,000 years and 10 years, 10 generations later, people were dying under 200. So you see how God reduced the lifespan of man in order to remove that which was initially given to man as a good, but he abused it. So therefore, this was taken away. And of course, God knows the outcome, but he never does something until man demonstrates the need. So he knew that, you know, Adam and Eve were going to sin, but he doesn't bring a punishment until they actually do it. That would be unjust to punish man, even though God knew he was going to do it, but God didn't make him do it. It was something which he had to allow man. He created man in the most perfect form, and even in that form, the battle was too strong, so he gave in to the sin. So you see that God's teaching is how he made some changes in man in order to a concession to man, so he can still exist, but in a state where he would be have more defense against sinning. So here also, a person has, King Solomon is talking about, what is the fuel behind these feelings that he talks about, that people are looking for these fantasies about the physical world, and looking for senses of accomplishment, and building empires. Where does the fuel of all those fantasies come from? Immortality. That's why this verse comes next. He's now explaining to you the phenomena that there's a futility of futilities. In general, man always creates fantasies about the objects he's going after and his pursuits. And one very primary one is verse 3, which is the sense of accomplishment. And then he explains in verse 4, where is the energy, the fuel behind this, because a person feels he's going to be here forever. That feeling of immortality is something which causes a person to build great empires. But if a person knew he's dying this afternoon, do you think he's going to go to the office and start being involved in the great empire builder fantasy that he has? No. That's what the people that Calvi mentioned later, earlier, that they have that later in life, because now they realize that everything they work for is going to fade away sooner than later, because now they're coming closer to the end. So that's why reality is now undeniable to them. So King Solomon is exposing us to the fact generations go and generations come. So don't feel that sense of permanence. Live your life happily, but don't follow a feeling of immortality, because then that's going to allow you the ability to follow these fantasies about, endless empire building of my business, and I'm going to build the next location, and so on and so forth. Okay. Now what he does, he gives a little bit of he spells this out just a little bit. He says in verse 5, and again, I'm basing this all on the class that Rabbi Chait gave. He says in verse 5 that the sun will shine, and then the sun will set, and to its place will it shine forth from there. And verse 6 is connected. It goes to the south, and then it encompasses the path, and it goes to the north, and then it circles and circles, meaning going over the same path again and again. Does the wind go? And the commentaries say, meaning the wind that's associated with the movement of the sun. And on its paths, the wind returns. Okay. So this is odd. Now he moves on to the sun, and he talks about how it rises and it sets, and to its place it shines forth again, and it goes to the south, and it goes to the north, and then it keeps on going on the same path. What phenomena is he describing now? It doesn't say new here.
Yeah, I know. You're right.
It seems to be like the theme is like it's a there's a repetition going on.
Yeah, the repetition theme.
Right. That the sun rises, sets, and it goes back to its place, and then it's going to start again. Then it goes, but then he adds something. It goes to the south. Then it encompasses and goes up to the north, and then it circles and circles again. And on its very paths, does the wind return?
translation says, as the sun arises and the sun sets into its place, it rushes.
Okay.
Which gives you the sense of, I mean, what I think of is the businessman rushing to do his work. I may be pulling the wrong analogy here.
Let's see if we can get the repetitive theme going. And also, he talks about going to the south and going to the north. Places, destinations.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be that, again, if I'm taking an analogy to what a person would do, so we run around thinking all the stuff we're doing is so very important, and yet, you know, the wind goes round and round, and when it's round, it returns, and it's like just you think in the moment that you're in it, in that particular day, that it's very important because, you know, you're rushing here and you're rushing there and you're moving to the south and you're flying to this place, but at the end, that it just all kind of comes around to the same old repetitive stuff.
Right, exactly. I mean, he's talking about the phenomena in action that he was just discussing. Meaning a person is looking for a certain satisfaction, accomplishment, and it's because, you know, again, he has fantasy is attached to the physical world. And then he talks about a specific fantasy about accomplishment. And then he tells you why a person does this, because he feels he's going to be here forever. And then he shows you, however, that this very act, the person is, how does it work? It's like the sun going around. It just keeps on going over and over again. Let's look and see what really happens, King Solomon says. It's just rising and setting, and it goes back to its place. And but sometimes you say, oh, let's go over here to the south, or let's go to the north, meaning new destinations. Like a person is trying to fool himself that there's something that's going on over here. Hey, I'm going here, I'm going there. But in fact, you're going in circles. So he's describing the phenomena how a person will fool himself. Right, so he's just spelling out the, okay. And Helen is just mentioning on screen, she's saying that people who seek this world like money or position never have enough money or status. They always have to get more. They have to go round and around. Okay, there's actually a verse that spells that out, Helen, that says that more literally. But here you see that the person makes up like the destination, that there's some value here. Okay, so and the person does this on a regular basis, he's saying now. So that's the new concept over here, is that the person is constantly on the move. That's a new point. Why is he on the move? So Rabbi Chait explained the next verse, Zion 7. Another beautiful verse. He says, all the rivers go to the sea, but the sea isn't full. And to the place that the rivers go, there they go, they return, or they collect to go again. All the rivers go to the sea, but the sea does not become full. And to the place that the rivers go, meaning the sea, there, at that point, they go further. Okay, so what? Now we talk about water flowing, and it goes to the sea, but it doesn't get full. And again, the verses are in sequence. That means that they're here to explain the previous one.
It would seem at least like the example of the sea is answering the question of, well, the person's constantly on the move because they're seeking that unique sense of having accomplished something that somehow makes a big difference
Well, that sounds like the previous verse. So the person's just repeating. What does it mean that the sea isn't full? And all the rivers are flowing into the sea. And how would this be related to perhaps explain the previous verse, number 6? Actually, 5 and 6 are together. Meaning 5 and 6 are talking about the practical actions of the human being. Going here, going there, returning, rising, setting. And why does that happen? What would explain that phenomenon? What is the contributing factor that phenomenon is a reality? That a person will keep on going over and over again on the same path. Evidently, King Solomon is surprised. The person keeps on doing the same thing. And if a person is not getting the satisfaction, why doesn't he just stop? So that's what verse 7 is coming to explain.
Is it because man's desire and seeking after that sense of accomplishment is unending?
And why is that? Let's look into man's psychological nature. What can we pinpoint as being the cause of that? Stop after a while. Why is this an endless thing? Again, he goes around the circuit. He keeps on going around and around.
Because he can't find fulfillment for that which, for those ego satisfactions that he's striving to fill, there's no way he can fulfill them.
Right. That's part of it. You're right. And that'll be the next verse. But there's something more prior in time to that. What Rav Chait said was that this verse 7 is a parable for the libido. Why is it that a person can keep on going around and around? It's because the libidinous energy of a person does not have an end. Kol hanachom, all the rivers, they go to the sea, but the sea isn't full. The energy keeps on flowing, and it never ends. And to the place that it flows, there it collects to go further. There it returns to go further, meaning it doesn't stop. The energy of man doesn't stop. That, psychologically, is what King Solomon is explaining, the cause for a person being able to constantly go over the same exact path. He keeps on beating the path over and over and over again. Then what you just said comes in verse 8, where he's not getting satisfaction. We'll have to explain why, and then why does that come next? But the first thing is to really see the action. That's in verses 5 and 6. That's the phenomena that takes place in man's life. Verse 7 explains the psychological cause, why he can keep on doing this, why he never stops, is because the energy doesn't stop. And in 8, so now it explains that all these matters that he's going after, they're wearying. They just tire him out. A man is not able to speak about them. He can never stop discussing all these different possibilities. The eye is never satisfied from seeing, and the ear is never satisfied, never full from hearing. Fullness means that the satisfaction is never reached. Right? The satisfaction that man is seeking, since he's seeking it where? On earth, as a ends in itself. So all this great faculties that God has given us, the libido and the ingenuity, but if we're applying it only to the physical because of some fantasy that we're chasing after, so then we're just going to weary ourselves because we never realize the satisfaction, because we're looking for satisfaction in the physical realm alone. If, however, a person would put his energies into the world of wisdom, so then he would find great satisfaction, because now he's just amazed at the insights, and that sense of amazement is something which meets the part of the person that's really the center of man, meaning his soul, his intellect. And when he sees that, he starts recognizing the tremendous capacity that the intellect has and what world of wisdom is out there. And it amazes him. And that's a satisfying existence. So you see how the sequence of verses is now giving you an insight into human nature. And it makes sense that he does this, because as you're about to embark on this whole book of 12 some odd chapters, on the right ideas and morality and ethics and philosophy of life, which is the primary focus, you have to first understand what the human being is in order to appreciate why the rest of the book is an accurate critique and also contains accurate suggestions. A doctor can't prescribe medication until he studies the body. So a person can't appreciate the philosopher's critiques and advice unless he understands the structure of the human being. So that's why he commences the book this way. And I'm of the opinion that is the same thing that happens in Genesis, the very beginning. First it talks about the creation of what happened on each day. But then there's another account of the creation that talks about how the plants work, and they weren't growing, and there was no water on the ground, and then it goes into man, and it talks about the snake and then these rivers. So I'm of the opinion that if you study into it, you can see the analogies to human nature there, and many lessons. And what's interesting is that in both cases it talks about rivers.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I was thinking in the part about the rivers running to the sea that the individual rivers is kind of analogous to a person's life and how they spend all this time running around, but eventually they just wind up where everybody else winds up, in the grave, you know, in this sort of big pool, and how important were they really?
The rivers here, you mean?
Yeah, like the individual rivers, they're all going to kind of wind up in the same place anyway. And so if we just look at our lives as just what we have here on earth, and then we end up in the grave, you know, in this big sort of pool, so how important was it if we don't do something more with our purpose?
Right, agreed. That's definitely true. That's definitely true.
Rabbi, when Rabbi Chait refers to verse 7 as like libido,
yes,
is he talking about just the generalized energy of man, or is he specifically talking about sexual energy there?
In general. Okay. Just that man has a tremendous amount of energy, and that's why you see people constantly on the move. That's what the previous verses were. 5 and 6 were about a person is on the move, he's always doing this, but why? Even though he goes over the same path over and over again, what's propelling him? Ah, there is a propeller, and that's the libidinous energy. It's a great amount of energy that a person has. And you see how a person can really harness it. You see both ends of the spectrum. You can have somebody like an Einstein, and then you have somebody like a Trump, who puts all of his energies into building. So a lot can be accomplished. The only thing is which one is worthwhile and which one's not. Sure, people are impressed by the latter. But I guarantee you, he will have tremendous remorse when his end comes too. Because what was it all for? Many people ask that question to themselves. All right, and he goes on in verse 9. And he says, what was, that which, that is what will be. What was done, that is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun.
It could be rather discouraging.
Yeah. If you're looking for a certain thing.
Yeah.
See, this in the next verse, Chait said it was referring to a certain emotion. Because verse 10 says, there is a thing which a person will say, look, this is new. But no, King Salman says, that was already in many worlds past, many generations past. That would be for us. Right, so 9 and 10 go together. He gives the rule, but then he gives an expression of the rule. The rule is that everything which was and which was done in the past, is, I mean, anything that you will do or that is now, this was already done in the past. There's nothing new under the sun. So what is he addressing? What's the emotion he's addressing here?
Can't be iPhones.
No, that's the one exception to the rule.
Well, I mean, is it as straightforward as, you know, if you think you're, let's take the businessman, building up an empire that's going to last, you know, so did a whole bunch of people before you, hundreds of years before you, and, you know, look what happened to them. And you can't even remember who they were. So a few hundred years from now, nobody's going to remember who you are either.
Okay, what emotion is it expressing? No, I don't see the immortality here. What's the key word here? What's the new concept here? And that was a hint.
No recollection?
No recollection. No. And Mike... Mike in Ohio was suggesting the feelings and thoughts of man, maybe. Well, that's very general. The whole thing is really talking about that, Mike. What's a new word here?
Are you looking for the word new itself?
There you go. That's what he says in 10. There is something which a person will say. Look at this. It is new. And that's what the whole verse 9 was talking about. That which was, that is what will be. And that which was already performed in the past, and that will be performed again. There is nothing new. You see, he says it in 9, and he also says it again in 10. So now he's repeating it. He's trying to point you. That's the issue that we're talking about over here. So a person is looking for something new. Why? But what would newness do? If there's something new, see what Rabbi Chait explained over here is one word: the emotion of modernity. The feeling that each generation throughout time has always felt we're living in the era. We've surpassed everybody before us. This is new. we're on the cutting edge. We're on the frontier. A person or is looking to substantiate his existence. Another fantasy that there's value. How do I look at value? Contrast to everybody else. Who's everybody else? Previous generations. But he says no. People say here there's something new. In verse 10, King Solomon comes in and says no. This already was for previous generations. This already was for the previous generations that were before us.
So, that makes sense.
Yes, so that feeling, that's another reservoir that the person will bank on in order to substantiate the self. You see, there's a great insecurity that a person is constantly looking for different areas to demonstrate to himself that he's value. Oh, our generation, I'm living in the generation, this is it. Almost as if he's saying, like you said before, like we've got it all, we're never going to die. But never dying is a separate thing, but that goes in hand. Because any real type of fantasy of accomplishment never includes the reality of death in it. So this is a new point he's bringing in, that this is something which really permeates people. But he says, no, anything you could think of that was done or performed or happened, it's going to happen in the future again too. Qualitatively, there's nothing. You want to talk about success? There are plenty of people who have success beforehand. Oh, your success is new? Don't fool yourself. This is something which goes also. But he says, you see, he really verbalizes a very concrete case in the beginning of 10. And he says, there is something which a person will say, look, here, there's something new. It's like he's quoting the words, like the excitement. Ah, this is it. We've got it now. There's also another emotion that this touches on. And that is that a person will, I believe, feel a certain competitive feeling to previous generations. And here, saying we've got something newer than they've got, says, yeah, they were old timers. They were like, they were, the 1900s. They didn't have, they 1800s, they didn't even have car engines yet. But we've got it. So somehow a person feels that makes him superior. But you see that, why is he trying to look superior in his mind to the previous generation? Evidently there's a threat. And I believe the threat might be multifaceted. One is because we are only here because of the previous generation. If there were no previous people, we would not be here. So all of a sudden, I owe my existence to previous people. So that's something that my ego doesn't tolerate. I don't want to feel dependent. So somehow I have to raise myself above it. Oh, we're new. So I'll take the very fact that it's a timeline, and that's where the threat comes from. So that is from where my response is going to be. Meaning it's true, and I don't want to face the fact that I'm only here because of previous generations. But yeah, we're new. We've got better things than them. But it says no. That don't try to substantiate yourself that way. So when a person realizes that, so what's the next thing he moves on to try to substantiate himself? So it's the last verse in this series, and that is 11. King Solomon says, there's no remembrance to the first generations and also to those afterwards that will be. There will be no remembrance to them. Im shiyu le'achrona, with those that will be afterwards. Now he's talking about a new thing called a remembrance. So a person, and my friend Louis Barbanel gave a very nice explanation to this, why it says, I was wondering, why doesn't it just say there's no remembrance to people, and end the verse right there? But no, he says there's no remembrance to the first generations, meaning us, and those that will be afterwards. There is no remembrance. to those who will be at the later time. Because if a person can't get the validation in his mind while he's here, and to somehow make himself a mark, so he feels, well, at least it's something called a legacy. I'll be remembered. And somehow in the person's mind, he feels, it's a trick of the mind, he's now again trying to validate his existence with a new means of feeling that he has worth. And what is that? People will remember me. I'll have a plaque put up on some building somewhere. It'll always be there. But that's something which is foolish, because once he's dead, he's not aware of it. So that's foolish. But you see how a person's, you know, grabbing at straws now. And why does he say the generation after that won't have it? Because that's the generation that it's going to be passed on to. So there's not going to be any remembrance to you, the Rishonim, the first ones, meaning you. And if you're going to think that it's going to be some value to you because the next generation will remember you, well, aren't they also going to pass away? So he even goes with the person's fantasy. You think that just your memory is going to be something of a value, but to those people who are doing the act of remembering you will also die. Now what are you going to say? That's why he has both generations, you and the next one. Not just to say that you won't be around, but those that you feel are going to be remembering you so fondly, and you think this is going to give you some value. First of all, there is no value. You're not even there. Second of all, those who you imagine in your fantasy are going to be recalling you, they also will expire. So now, where is your worth? He's completely pulling the carpet out from that fantasy. You see?
Yeah, so it's like sort of double generation. You think the next generation will remember you, but not only will they not, but they're also going to not be remembered, so it's sort of a double whammy.
Yeah, well, not that they're not going to be remembered, but that you will not be remembered by them, because they will die, too.
Right.
And you see, this really ends a segment over here, because the next verse starts, again, I am Kohelis. I used to be king of Israel in Jerusalem. Now it seems to be starting over a new area. So the first, and now he starts going into the, after he gives you the whole analysis and basic themes of a person, and the fact that there is something called fantasy, there is, we just take them, we just review, because they're very important. See, the first thing is that he's worthwhile to listen to because he was one who spoke in public. That's the word Kohelis in congregations. He was a son of a wise man, David, and he was also the king, so he had everything at his disposal. Then in verse 2, he says how there is a thing called the fantasy. That's the futility of all futilities, because a person will have something futile connected to the actual worthless pursuits. And the thing which is connected to the worthless pursuit is the fantasy of how good this will be. So that's a double futility. That's what it means, futility of futilities. Then he talks about the false sense of accomplishment that a person is looking for on top of what he really rightfully should look for, food, clothing, and shelter for himself and his family. But then he says, no, he also wants to have the image of the successful businessman. That, he says, is futile. That does not do anything for you. Then he speaks about immortality in verse 4. A generation goes and another one comes. Only the world stays. So the generations come and go. And there he attacks the feeling of immortality, because that's really what is the building blocks, the foundation for the person to have the previous fantasies. The person only has fantasies about success and great businessman and so on and so forth because he feels he's here eternally. He feels that he is immortal. And then verse 5 talks about the practical expression of where the person is moving. I'm going here, I'm going there. He's making all these constant moves on the same paths. I'm going to the south, I'm going to the north, I'm going here, I'm going there. Like, there's some value to that. But he keeps on going over and over again. And why does he keep doing it? Because of verse 7, that the libidinous energy has no end. That's what keeps the person going. But he chooses the wrong activity, so that's why he keeps on repeating it over and over again. And that's why verse 8 comes to tell you that he gets tired from it because he's applying all of his energy, which he should have used for the pursuit of wisdom and kindness and so on. But no, it's all self-centered and earthbound. So it's just going to weary him out because he keeps on doing it over and over again and never gets satisfied. The eye could never, person can never talk enough about what it is because it's endless and he doesn't get anywhere. There's no satisfaction. The eye never gets full. The ear never gets full. Fullness is satisfaction. That's why, again, it speaks of the fullness when it talks about the libido, right? It says right before this that the sea is never full. Okay, so that was verse 8. And verse 9 was the feeling of modernity. Person wants to feel that, yeah, we, our generation, we've got it. We're more advanced because of the threat of the fact that we come from the previous generation. And we want to substantiate and validate ourselves as really the ego needs expression, but it feels threatened by the fact that we're only here due to the previous generation. So we say, ah, new things. We fool ourselves that with advances in technology that this now makes us superior somehow. But this is not true. This is not going to give you anything because you really boil it down. The iPhone is just another way of talking to somebody with two cans and a string. Right? So it's nothing new. Right? Don't tell Steve Jobs I said that because he'll just collapse. And then the last verse is the remembrance. A person will feel, well, all else fails, I've always got that one last holdout, and that's, I'll be remembered. He says that's a mistake too, because who's going to remember you if those people themselves pass away? So the idea is nonsensical, and it doesn't even happen. Because the people who do remember you pass away, and that's it. Nobody today can recall a generation from 200 years ago. Talk, who lived in a certain corner in Brooklyn even 100 years ago? I mean, it's gone. That's not worth to be looking for worth. Anything which is earthbound, he really shows how it's a problem. And it does not give you satisfaction. All right. Well, we see if there's any questions or comments at this point.
None here. Seems clear.
Okay. All right. All right, so why don't we pick up from here next week. We'll start with verse 12, okay? And if you want to look further, the next couple of verses, I unfortunately never got to retrieve my notes from this point further. I left them out years ago, and so we're just going to be doing this together new. So it should be very adventurous, at least for me, because it'll be working without the, I mean, up to this point, I recall, you know, what I mentioned to you, you know, most of it is taken straight, you know, from Rabbi Chait's class. I had gone over that a number of times, so I remembered that. So we'll go further from this point a week from today, same time. Sounds good?
That sounds great.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. A very important opening to the whole book.
Yeah.
And if you want, look at the beginning of Genesis and see. Look for the parallels.
Okay.
All right. All right, so I guess we'll pick up next week, and I wish everybody a really good week, and look forward to continuing it.
All right, Rabbi. Thanks. You have a great week.
You too. Have a good week to everybody.
Hey.
Take care.
Okay, be well. Okay, so they'll wrap it up for today. We'll continue next week, same time. I'm not sure when we'll turn the clocks back, but just keep that in mind. I think the next week or two, I think we are. All right, so good week to everybody. Okay, Helen, thanks for joining. Mike, JHS, and Yoshio. Have a good week.